everybody. Welcome to this week's episode of the OIG Roundtable. I got to tell you, Matt, we were this close. Wade was back. He was back in action.
It was like, half hour ago, we get, sorry, can't make it.
And then that's it. And that's it. He had what appeared to be a free Friday. And then, boom, the road to hell is paved with good intention.
And contracts with CMS.
And contracts with CMS. So Wade had to go, and so we're back to the OIG coffee table, off the heels of a great OIG roundtable with the interloper Dave Beetler. I think, you know, I've gotten feedback already. I can't believe it. I got a text message this morning from a well-known SIU director who thought that having Dave on was good. So you know, I think maybe.
Wade who?
But so, you know, we'll persevere. We'll slog through, Matt. Yep. So what's actually interesting is it's a great segue to the topic for today. We talk about ROI. We talked about credentialing, and this is one which kind of brings it full circle. In my great state of New Jersey, there were two sentencings. One for a pharmacy technician, recently, and then in April, I'm looking at it now. It's up to tell when, but in April there was a sentencing. So we have a pharmacist in Jersey City, and we have a pharmacy technician that worked for him. Both were engaged in submitting false statements relative to an audit to a PBM is how it looked. And it looks like what they were doing was they were sending in falsified records for proof of delivery to patients. And proof of delivery is either the patient walked in and signed for it or what have you. So there were some altered records there that were sent in response to an audit that was conducted by a PBM, investigational audit. And then collaterally, it looks like they were submitting claims for prescriptions that were never filled. Now, in the PBM space, PBMs, from your documentation perspective, right, it's always very important to remember that PBMs do not have relationships with the prescribing physicians. The relationships are with the pharmacies. That's the network relationship. And so when a PBM is doing its investigation, the PBM can't ask the provider or the, not the provider, the prescribing physician for documents. They can ask them, but there's no contractual obligation for the doctor, nurse practitioner, PA, whoever it is, to actually submit the medical records that support it. It has to go through the pharmacy. The pharmacy has a responsibility to do that. But when looking at PBM investigational audits, typically there's a handful of documents that the PBM can ask for from the pharmacy. And one of those documents is going to be proof of delivery or proof of pickup. And what we know from the press releases is that there were some fabricated documents that were provided that supported that the patient picked up records when they picked up the prescriptions when they didn't pick them up. And so that, you know, obviously created a vulnerability because you've got essentially false statements being made, which is what ultimately the technician and the pharmacist pleaded guilty to and were sentenced to. We were talking about a lot of money. It was well over $600,000 for what appears to be a one-month period. I didn't go back and look at the information or the complaint to look and see how long it actually spanned. My guess is that the time period that they chose to have as the plea is the time period for the audit. And so, you know, sometimes the juice is worth that squeeze of the audit. But what we know, Matt, is that there were a couple of things that went on. One is that we know from the press release that there was a text message exchange between the pharmacist and a friend. And I'm reading from it where it says, quote, during the scheme, Patel sent text messages, Patel meaning Kirtan Patel, the owner of the pharmacy, also known as probably the pharmacist in charge or PIC, owned a Jersey City pharmacy, but it's says Patel sent text messages to a friend describing how Patel billed around $8,000 to $10,000 every month to his own insurance and did not take any medications. So that's basically free money. He also described how he plied doctors with trips to strip clubs nightclubs and cash to keep them as corrupt as possible. So the first thing, obviously, is there's no honor amongst thieves. Are there other cases that came out as a result of that? For anybody that keeps up on these things, in the great state of New Jersey, we had the Biodiagnostic Lab case, which at the time was the largest kickback case in the country. It was about $50, $60 million. And one of the things that we knew from investigating that case was that the owners of BLS were paying cash kickbacks, but they were also paying for strip clubs, prostitutes, private jets to football games, and as they would say, hookers and blow on the planes. So we know that that's obviously a thing. It's a vulnerability. But what this does tell us, and that's really the heart, is the importance of credentialing and the vulnerability that not linking credentialing your provider and your technicians or your ancillary providers to being able to not submit claims on behalf of themselves. Like we know in the Medicare space, and we know that in a lot of the commercial space, you cannot bill for your own care. And so this presents a huge vulnerability from a credentialing perspective that should be part and parcel to that process.
Does this go back to like the point of sale stuff for pharmacy being somewhat unique? Because a doctor that submits a claim for, you know, doing an E&M on him or herself, denied. This, $8,000 to $10,000 a month for prescriptions filled for him or her, for himself, went through without a problem. His technician, same thing. Submitted claims, or maybe individually or through Patel, for prescriptions for him, for himself, paid without a problem. How does that happen if they were credentialed correctly and there were edits, there should have been edits in the system to stop those claims from being paid?
But even at a point, but even at a point of sale arrangement, which is why pharmacy is unique, because the average person, when you go to the pharmacy and you pick up a prescription, it's a point of sale transaction. You don't get an explanation of benefits, an EOB, or in the Medicare space, EOMB, explanation of Medicare benefits. You just know when you pick up your prescription, you get something that gets stapled to your bag that says your insurance saved you this much money or whatever it is. You don't know that it happened or it didn't happen. If a pharmacy is fraudulently billing your pharmacy benefit for medication or whatever it may be, you oftentimes don't even know that. But so I don't think that the point of sale transaction arrangement changes anything, because at the end of that transaction, you still need to submit, the pharmacy still needs to submit with the ordering physician's information, with the name of the pharmacist, like, you know, under the D.0, which is from the NCPDP, all that information is on that claim. And when it gets processed through the clearinghouse, it gets kind of normalized to whatever PBM it's going to. So I don't think that the point of sale nature necessarily changes it, but certainly from a credentialing perspective, if you're the pharmacist that's working at a pharmacy, your name is on that claim. And by the way, pharmacy technicians, because we know in this case that a pharmacy technician was also doing this, pharmacy technicians, and certainly in the state of New Jersey, are licensed. There's an exam, you have to pass a competency test, you get a license. What, you know, that should be part of that credentialing piece of the puzzle, because we know that pharmacists in charge are listed. When there's a change of ownership, it's listed. This is something that I think is probably a loophole in the process that doesn't get its muster from the credentialing, because the credentialing comes from the PBM side, not on the medical side.
And think about how larger it is, a vulnerability, considering the PBM doesn't have the legal authority to go to the prescriber to validate the prescription. So the only one-step validation is the pharmacy, who is not, you know, not the victim in this, but is the perpetrator. So
right.
Now the pharmacy checks and balances.
Now what typically happens in a PBM investigation is there are typically a couple of things that go as kind of a standard: prescriber verifications, member verifications. And unfortunately, what happens is those typically go out in a hard copy mailing, where the prescriber is asked, did you, you know, did you prescribe this medication to this patient of yours on this date? Yes or no? And same thing with members. You get this, did you see this doctor on this date? Did you go? And what we know, or at least what I know from having worked with many of the PBMs over the years, both at my time at the OIG and even here doing expert work for some of the PBMs, is that the response rates to those solicitations is not always all that high. And then oftentimes, if the investigator makes a phone call or a follow-up reach out to the prescriber, oftentimes those go unanswered. And so oftentimes the problem is that the response rates are super low. And then you're relying upon the pharmacy to provide that. It's similar to the PBMs don't have relationships with the wholesalers. And so when the invoices are being reviewed for reconciliation, the PBM says to the pharmacy, please get your wholesaler invoices and have them sent to us. But we know from a lot of these cases that what happens is the nefarious relationships, the shady wholesalers are sending that information to the pharmacy first, and someone at the pharmacy is saying yes or no, send that along, or no, do this because of whatever that shadiness is. And I've seen that on email exchanges, you know, from my days at OIG. We've kind of all seen that. So, you know, the PBMs are sometimes a little bit of a rock and a hard place on that, but you know, you still have at this point of sale that shouldn't negate the fact that the claims that were processed over, it looks like $1.2 million in claims were paid from forfeiture and restitution. It looks like there's, you know, two different numbers there. But the argument kind of is at the credentialing phase, should PBMs be working more closely with the medical, right? Is this, number one, the first question is the prescribing physician in network, right? In the Part D world, we know that if a doctor, non-physician practitioner, if you are not enrolled in Medicare, you cannot make an ancillary order. If you are not in the Medicare program and Eric Rubenstein still wants to go see Dr. Kuchansky, who's not in Medicare and I'm Medicare, and I want to pay you $100 for the visit because you can't bill insurance, and I'll take your $100 fee, but you write me a prescription for something, I can't get that prescription filled using my Part D insurance. If you order an MRI, I can't go and have my Part B insurance pay for that MRI because I'm not in the Medicare program. And I think that's where some of this has to come into play, is that even if you've got on the commercial side, if you've got a medical doctor writing an order for a prescription for medication, Is there a collective? Is the doctor in the network of the insurance that the PBM is now responsible for? Number one, is that box being checked? Yes or no? Then the second question is, if it's being checked, then the second thing is the pharmacy in network? And if the pharmacy is in network, is there a checkbox to make sure that the pharmacist isn't submitting claims to his own insurance for that?
And here, if you... the way this scheme was set out, the scheme is pretty much seamless, because if they do go to the prescriber and ask, you know, did you prescribe these medications to the pharmacist, they might be the ones getting the lap dances.
That's right. So here's the other piece of this, which we don't know, is did the PBM or did the PBMs in question, now this is clearly based upon the age of the person, this may not even be a case involving, we're going to say, is this, you know, because they weren't charged with healthcare fraud, and it's tough to tell. I mean, the pharmacist Patel is 34 years old, no Medicare. This is going to be commercial insurance. Christopher Lugo, the tech, is 36. So we know there's no Medicare involved. So false statements, by the way, 18 U.S.C. 1035, which we don't quite see all the time, but false statements relative to healthcare programs and healthcare fraud as a statute are not limiting to Medicare or Medicaid. You could be charged under false statements for healthcare fraud and healthcare fraud, whether it's commercial or not. The only caveat is that what you can't be charged with is violation of the anti-kickback statute, which is probably why we haven't seen anything being charged yet on these doctors for this, because it, there's going to be a, you know, at least for part of this, is was there Medicare or Medicaid involved in this? That doesn't mean that U.S. Attorney's offices can't go back and default to the statute that was used in the BLS case, which is the Travel Act, which is where you would get some of that commercial. So there are a lot of nuances to this. But when we're talking about credentialing, the thing that I will, you know, that I'm curious about is, did the PBM in question, because there's clearly going to be one PBM in question for this because it's his insurance and Lugo's insurance, is did they have a carve out that said you can't, like they do in the Medicare space or a lot of the medical claims, where you can't submit claims for, to your own insurance for your own stuff, like a doctor submitting. Now, you know, obviously the question is going to be is if this defendant or the technician, if they legitimately needed these prescriptions, and we're talking about, we don't know the drugs, but clearly it's a 1 month period. It's probably a high dollar drug. The question is there a carve out for this? Would this have otherwise been legitimate? If the prescription was real, would insurance have paid for it, right? And that's where you have to kind of look and see, is there a carve out in the credentialing? So I don't want to get too askew to say, oh, you know, this is a failure of the credentialing process, but it does beg the question of, if you do have a condition that does require a high dollar prescription, you know, how is there a carve out for that? I mean, what I would think is, if I am the PBM and I am going to get a claim for a $500,000 for $500,000 in prescriptions for myself, I would flag that immediately and say, please produce. We're not saying you're not, but there's almost like, as a check and balance, should there be a pre-authorization for all of that, where we can at least go through the machinations to say whether or not this was legitimate or not?
Right. The other thing that's interesting is this conduct took place in 2020. The sentencing just occurred. So that's, you know, 5.5, 6 years later. Does that mean there may be, there may have been other prosecutions and things of those doctors where these two perhaps were, you know, cooperating with that? That that's what took 5 years to get to this point, is that maybe there are Medicare kickback cases that just aren't mentioned in this press release, that this might be the finally got to the pharmacy owner, now we're done.
Right. So, you know, a lot of times in the press releases, we'll see information about other defendants in the case. But what does come up interesting is the fact that Patel, that there's quotes from text messages. Yeah. So the question becomes, were the text messages obtained separately via search warrant, or was there cooperation going on between them? Now, obviously, the thing that kind of begs this question about that is the fact that you've got both Lugo and Patel got prison time. And what you often see is, if there's restitution and a forfeiture amount and the insurers in question are made whole, sometimes you see that the individual gets a 5 year 5 years probation, they get time served, they get community service, they get something else. There was nothing in the press release that says that. And again, we're not diving deep into this. You know, we're just kind of taking this press release at face value. So could there have been some cooperation and some other things that went on? Yes, that's entirely possible. The other thing too is, it's in 2020, so you have COVID, and maybe they're just wrapping up things that were in the post-COVID world that were, this wasn't pressing. Maybe both Patel and Lugo signed plea agreements, and it's just been kind of sitting there until the dust settled. Remember, District of New Jersey went through a number of changes in who their U.S. attorney was. They had some acting U.S. attorneys. There was a lot of turnover in the transition in the administration. These things kind of happen. So it just could be possible that some of these other collateral things. But I think for us, the takeaway, not to spend too much time engrossed in the facts of the case, but certainly I just think from a credentialing perspective, this is something that, you know, if you're the medical side of the, you know, plan, and you've engaged your PBM, I would just want to make sure, like, as part of that credentialing, the PBMs do separate credentialing, but you know, you just want to kind of make sure when you're doing that credentialing on the PBM side, are the PBMs, what are they doing to ensure that if there is a carve out that says, as the pharmacist, I can submit claims for my own medications, you know, that's okay. My question would be, if I'm submitting a claim for my own medication, should I be doing it at my pharmacy? And I think that's really the defining point, right? If Dr. Jones goes to Dr. Smith, Dr. Smith can submit a claim for Dr. Jones. Dr. Jones can't submit a claim for himself. So are you limiting and saying to Patel, no one is saying you can't get this prescription. You just shouldn't be filling it in your own pharmacy. And any sort of professional courtesies that the pharmacy, another pharmacy might want to give you that are within the law, whatever, that's going to be between you and them. But there's probably some other pieces of that puzzle to say, hey, you can't fill your own prescriptions. It's not saying you can't get a prescription filled. You should just be going to another pharmacy to get that prescription filled. Now, whether there's a fox in the henhouse scenario, about some other collateral kickback arrangement is separate from this discussion.
Yeah, it's just the amounts, $10,000 a month, that should have keyed them in pretty quickly that there was something going on.
That's an orphan drug. That's a high dollar drug. That may be your HIV medications.
HIV, it might be hepatitis drug, something like that.
Yeah, something like that. So it's interesting. I mean, I just think from our perspective, it's less about the facts of the case. And it's more about the credentialing piece. I mean, I know when we collectively read this separately, then we got, we're talking about this. It's like the credentialing piece becomes kind of the most important piece of the interaction is how are these providers credentialed? And that becomes a piece of that investigative puzzle where you could be looking at things even proactively. This is one of those potential quick ROI discussions. You know, here's your network of docs. Do we have any claims from docs that they're submitting it on their own behalf? And then collaterally, here's our network of pharmacies and who's listed as the pick, who listed as the technicians. Are any claims going in where the filling pharmacist is the same as the,
as the patient?
Patient. Yeah. Yeah, so interesting stuff. Just gets back to why credentialing is so important and how these things kind of need to be tightened up to prevent wayward dollars from going out the door. So good conversation. Wade, I always appreciate the interaction and never mind.
He's still on the phone with CMS.
He probably still is. And so, you never know. Dave Beachler he could be the Vanilla Ice of the roundtable. Don't call it if there's a problem, he'll solve it. He also might be the LL Cool J. Don't call it a comeback. So, those early 90s, late 80s rap references. And we do call Dave Beachler the plain white rapper.
If we hadn't, we are from now on.
That's true story. That is true story. So, thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Thanks for the feedback on having Dave Beachler on. I guess we have to have him back again just to prove that, that he isn't a fake person. He's a real boy. So it'll be good to have him. Matt, have a good weekend. Good seeing you.
You too.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll see you on the next OIG Roundtable.